Time now for sports. Baseball's playoffs have begun, and the pitchers are smoking. And in college football, ball hurt a cold duck. But what about the Hot Ducks of Oregon? Tom Goldman joins us. Morning, Tom.
Hi, Scott.
And usually, you know, after a long regular season, you go into a cooler postseason weather, and pitchers can suffer from tired arms. But boy, have we had some great pitching. Of course, the classic, the no-hitter that Roy Halladay threw the other night against the Reds, and then Tim Lincecum's almost equally classic shutout for the Giants.
Yeah, amazing stuff. It was Halladay's second no-hitter of the year, too. He's a meticulous planner. He's very measured. You can see that in his demeanor, too. Lincecum's performance versus Atlanta, the 14 strikeouts, and he allowed only two hits. Some said that was even more impressive than Halladay's no-hitter, if you can believe that. And Lincecum, Scott, appears to be a polar opposite with his shoulder-length hair and the skateboarder clothes. Mm-hmm. Now, he certainly prepares, but meticulous isn't exactly the word that comes to mind. A Sports Illustrated article describes Lincecum eating Philly cheesesteaks or ice cream before he pitches, and he never
Babe
ices.
Ruth's treating training regimen. Yeah.
And he doesn't have the same girth, though, and he never ices his arm after pitching. Lincecum quotes his father, who says ice is made for two things, injuries and my drinks. Mm. And let's not forget Texas Rangers pitcher Cliff Lee. He was fantastic in the Game 1 victory over Tampa Bay.
I want to ask you about just one of my favorite moments. What a week it's been. Last night's games, let me just say, the Reds kind of fell apart against the Phillies.
Yeah.
Rick Ankiel of the Braves, who used to be a pitcher for the Cardinals, one of the most famous tragic flameouts in baseball history 10 years ago, the 2000 playoffs against the Braves. He was with the Cards, fell apart on the mound, went back into the minor leagues, came back as an outfielder, and last night he hit the game-winning home run in the 11th inning.
They don't make movies like that, Scott. Actually, they kind of did make a movie of Rick Ankiel. Well, The Natural, but also Bull Durham. Remember Nick LaLouche when he's throwing the ball all over the field and hitting the mascot?
Yeah,
I mean,
it wasn't
that bad for Ankiel, but it was pretty close. And as you say, he didn't quit the game. He reinvented himself as an outfielder, and he clawed his way back and reached this high point last night with that towering home run that left the stadium in San Francisco and splash down in the bay. Quite an amazing scene.
Out to your neck of the woods for some college football. The Oregon Ducks are third in the nation. I want to ask you what's behind their success while also noting, I think by my count, they've got five players going through the criminal justice system now, as we say, and not small charges, DUI to assault.
I know. Well, first, let's talk about the good stuff. Yeah. An offense that is devastatingly efficient. Here's some pertinent statistics. The Ducks gain more yards and score more points per game than any team in the nation. They are ranked 98th in the country in time of possession, which means they strike quickly. Mm-hmm. And as you say, the excitement in Oregon couldn't come at a better time. Actually, close to a dozen players got into varying amounts of off-field trouble in the offseason. But hey, Scott, winning sure helps fans forget the brawls and the robberies and the DUIs and the physical harassment charges, don't they?
Fans there, I don't forget about it.
Right.
You know my favorite, I don't mind telling you, my favorite team at the moment, and has
What's
been
it?
For, I love Boise State.
I know, the field, right? The blue field.
I like the blue field. I don't know why they're ranked only number four. Is there some bias against small schools?
Well, that BCS critics certainly allege bias, and it's hard to prove. But nothing could be better than if Boise State or TCU, another non-major conference school, ranked fifth in the nation currently. If one of them or both of them land in the national championship game at the end of the season, and if that happens, it could really shake up college football and this current system that's criticized each year because of the lack of a postseason playoff.
Yeah, I would love to see Boise State. I think they've earned the number one ranking. For
Go Broncos.
Yeah, exactly. All right, Tom. Always a pleasure. You know, we have a few seconds left. So who's going to win the Braves? I'm forgetting.
Braves Giants.
Yes, thank you.
Well, the Braves now go home. It's 1-1, and the Braves are the best team at home this season. So watch out for the suddenly resurgent Atlanta Braves. Thanks to Rick Ankiel.
And let's win it for Bobby Cox. NPR's Tom Goldman. You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News. It's a holiday weekend, both in the United States and Canada. On Monday, Americans celebrate Columbus Day. Canadians will commemorate their Thanksgiving. So, what's the difference? between American and Canadian Thanksgiving. Let's turn now to Rick Mercer. He's a satirist, at least I hope it's satire, and host of the Rick Mercer Report, a show is now in its eighth season on the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation. He joins us from Toronto. Rick, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Scott.
So how's Canadian, aside from a difference in date, how's Canadian Thanksgiving different?
It's similar. You know, you do the turkey, you do the, it's a celebration of the harvest. I don't believe it's as big a deal. Like, it's not as much a dress rehearsal for Christmas like it is in the United States. I think it's much more low key. But of course, just like your Columbus Day, it's at a time when everyone really wants a holiday. So it all works out.
But there are no pilgrims involved.
No, there's no pilgrims at all. It's all about the harvest. I guess maybe, again, that's why it's so much more of a bigger deal for you. No, it's all just about the harvest.
We're delighted to take advantage of this slender reed of fact to be able to talk to you. Now, you used to do a segment called Talking to Americans.
Yeah, I've been on TV, boy, you know, I'm 40 years old, and I've been on the CBC for 20 years. But in the old days, I used to do this segment, Talking to Americans. It was a great gig. I would fly down to the United States every single week for Monday, Tuesday, something like that. I could go to any city that I wanted to, and I would just talk to Americans on the street, basically about Canada, and I would make stuff up.
And our Capitol building in Canada is actually a downscale model of your Capitol building, except it's made out of ice. It's an igloo, you see. And we're worried about global warming and the fact that it might melt, so we're putting a dome over it. But in order to pay for it, we have to attract tourists. Would you be interested in visiting the Canada's national igloo?
Absolutely.
Yeah?
Sure.
Congratulations, Canada, on preserving your igloo.
Congratulations, Canada, on preserving your national igloo.
Yes, indeed.
Well, congratulations, Canada, on becoming part of North America.
Thank you very much.
The same thing to you, Rick.
Oh, my.
Now, is that, may I ask, is that just thoughtfully edited ignorance? I mean, are Americans, in fact, in that much abject ignorance?
Well, obviously it's edited, but the basis of the joke is, you know, in Canada, you grow up, we are next to the United States. We're watching whatever you're watching. We're following your news. It's obvious that we are inundated with American cultural information and political information, whereas the opposite is not true. You guys know nothing about Canada, and for some reason, perhaps because of an inferiority complex, we would find it hysterical that, you know, we could say, in Canada, we only have 23 hours in our day. And people would say, really? I had no idea. And they would believe it.
Hmm. I used to tell people that it actually took the Toronto Blue Jays that they could win the American League pennant with fewer victories than, say, the Yankees.
People would look at you and go, that makes sense. I can see that. Yeah.
You also have a segment on your show, which inevitably has been compared to The Daily Show with Jon Stewart.
Uh-huh.
How do you feel about that?
You know, it's good to be compared to a hit, obviously. I mean, the shows are actually quite different. I spend 80% of my broadcast out in far-flung regions of Canada on basically travelogue adventures. So it's very different. But the one thing that is similar is every week I do a commentary. There's segments about politics. It's a very current show. And I've covered politics for 20 years. So that's where the comparison comes in. And, you know, it's great.
I saw a bit recently where you were rigging a ship.
Oh, yeah, I get to do the most amazing things. We call it host in peril quite often because people love to see me risk my life or be in danger. And I think what people like about it is they sense Mercer is not an adrenaline junkie. Like, I'm not the guy who says, if someone says, hey, do you know, this long weekend, let's go skydiving. I would say, no, are you nuts? I just soon sit down and have a cup of tea. But yet on my job, I end up jumping out of planes. Last week, I got in an 18-wheeler and drove down a runway onto a skid track. The week before that, they put me in a car and sunk me to the bottom of a lake to see if I could escape without an oxygen tank.
Welcome to a scenic gravel pit on the outskirts of Winnipeg, Manitoba. In the hallowed halls of Canadian academia, there is one scientist who has dedicated his considerable talents to solving that most Canadian problem. What to do if you find yourself behind the wheel of a car that just happens to be underwater?
See, in Canada, a lot of roads go by lakes, so this is a problem. We don't think. You get in, your car goes in the water, and your car starts floating. It'll only float for a minute or two. Everyone gets on their cell phone and calls 911, and they go, the car's floating. Could you come get me? And they say, get out the window. And they go, well, it seems to be floating fine. And then by that time, you know, 3 minutes later, they find you at the bottom of a lake with a cell phone in your hand, your seatbelt on, your window rolled up. So you got to get that window down.
Thanks. I'll remember
that's
that.
That's it. I'm very passionate about that one.
So, Rick, no special plans for Canadian Thanksgiving?
Well, you know, I'm fortunate that I'm employed. And if you're in show business, of course, every night you go to bed and go, oh, my God, tomorrow I'll never, ever work again. So the downside is I don't get to sit around with friends and enjoy the turkey or family. And I have to get on a plane and fly to Charlottetown, PEI, and discover the potato harvest, something that Jon Stewart's never done.
Well, that's got to be a great potato harvest, right?
Oh,
I mean, those
yes.
potatoes are
it's
famous.
It's all potatoes. That's what they got.
Well, I hope you have a good Thanksgiving anyway.
I certainly will. Air Canada will do a lovely chicken thing, I'm sure. That's where I'll be. That's not so sad. That'll be my Thanksgiving dinner. It'll be on a plane somewhere.
Well, Rick, a pleasure talking to you. I hope we'll have the chance again.
Thank you.
Speaking to us, Rick Mercer, host of the Rick Mercer Report on CBC, joining us from Toronto. You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. A panda befriends three children and teaches them life lessons between sips of tea and slices of bamboo cake. That's the unlikely setup for the series of children's books that are written and illustrated in watercolor by John J. Muth. Zen Shorts, which received a Caldecott honor, Zen Ties, and the latest is Zen Ghosts. Combine the magic of a Zen tale told by John J. Muth with a mysterious ghost story, a full moon, and, in Zen Ghosts, a Halloween night. We're delighted to welcome John Muth to our studios. Thanks so much for being with us.
Well, thank you, Scott.
And first, why don't we just introduce this panda? Let's read the first few pages of Zen Shorts, if we could. His name is Stillwater.
Right. It is. Here's Zen Shorts.
Okay. That little boy at the door.
That's Carl, right. Michael, there's a bear outside, said Carl. A what? Called Michael. A bear. He's really big, and he's in the backyard. What's he doing? Michael asked. He's sitting. He has an umbrella, said Carl. An umbrella? By the time the boys got outside, their sister Addie was already talking with him. I'm sorry for arriving unannounced, said the bear. The wind carried my umbrella all the way from my backyard to your backyard. I thought I would retrieve it before it became a nuisance. He spoke with a slight panda accent.
So, this is Stillwater.
Yes.
How did Stillwater come into your creative imagination?
I had done a drawing of a panda wearing a very fat pair of pants, and it made me laugh. I didn't know what to do with it, but I thought it was pretty funny. But I threw it into a drawer, and I didn't think too much of it. And then I went on a little while later, I went on a tour, a book tour, and I got the chance to visit with children and to read some other books I had written previously. And through that tour, I got the sense of who it was that was reading my books and what kinds of things I'd like to talk about. And then I began to wonder, what would it be like to live as I did in the middle of the country, say, and to grow up a few doors down from a spiritual teacher? But what if it was a different kind of spiritual teacher? And I ran across that drawing, and I said, what if it was this guy? And it's obvious that he would be a Zen teacher. Maybe he's a panda. That's sort of how Stillwater came about.
I was rereading recently an interview with E.B. White, who I think is known by adults as one of the most masterful essayists ever in the English language. And, of course, many young readers know Stuart Little, for example, Charlotte's Web. And E.B. White says in the esteemed Paris Review interview series, you don't write down for children, you write up.
Oh, I think that's absolutely true. I think children are completely capable of intuiting wisdom as readily as adults are. They just don't have the verbal ability to put it into words or to examine it the way we do as adults. But my experience has been that they get this stuff very quickly. And even the kids who come to the book because it has the giant panda or tend to come back because there's some itch that's set going in their minds or their hearts to re-examine and re-examine what's going on. And I've gotten letters from kids saying, you know, well, why did you do this? And I don't quite understand that. And I think that may be the deepest way to get something from these stories.
Let's talk about Zen Ghost, this new book. I love the illustrations. First one we're taking a look here is the street filled with trick-or-treaters on a Halloween night and a full moon. Wonderful, wonderful little touches from the kids who were ghosts and sheets in the kind of middle distance. And then I just noticed you have a pumpkin seems to be running across the street under its own steam. Or is
really?
That just a very slender slender child? Yeah, look at that. See those little
and
legs.
Some of those
there?
Ghosts don't have feet either, so who knows what's exactly happening there.
I thought I'd ask you. And is there a chimpanzee dressed up as a cowboy, too?
I guess that, yes, that looks like a chimpanzee, doesn't it?
You would know, but yes, it sure does.
You know, we go out trick-or-treating with the kids, and it's, I seem to feel like I'm catching out of the corner of my eye all kinds of things like this anyway, so I'm just relaying what it is that I think is happening in the book.
What did you do before you wrote and illustrated your books?
I worked in comics for about 20 years before I started doing children's books, and with the birth of my son, I really wanted to start talking about different things than comic books had the room for at that time. So I did a little bit of work in Japan, which was a kind of interim time, and then started doing work that I could directly speak to kids in picture books here.
So did you consciously begin writing for your son?
I did. The very first book that I wrote and illustrated was called The Three Questions, and I had read the story by, it's based on a story by Leo Tolstoy. Mm-hmm. He's my favorite writer. And when I finished reading it, I'd read it once before, but when I finished reading it, it was right around the time of my son's birth, and I thought, I really want to give him the things that are, the tools that are in this story, the wisdom that's in this story, but I don't want him to have to wait until he can understand Tsarist Russia. So I sat down and decided to write it for kids and for myself, and that's how that started. And I think writing it for him was what the catalyst for continuing to write books and discovering what it is that I'm writing about.
I'm guessing that publishers, have they ever tried to suggest you where Stillwater goes next? Like,
oh, no.
Forgive me. Oh, all right. Stillwater really should meet a vampire because that's got...
No,
winner written all over
no.
it.
No, and that was never, I never intended to do a second book. The first one I thought was the whole thing. But then I was visiting my grandmother and I bumped up against an idea that could really best be handled by Stillwater, who seemed to be standing over there waving to me. So that's how the second book came about.
You would see a big panda waving at
yeah,
you, wouldn't
I, that's...
Yeah. Do you go through life seeing Stillwater?
Well, when I'm least expecting it, he's dancing on my porch. Yeah, it's true.
Must be a reinforced porch. John J. Muth, his new book, Zen Ghosts. And to enjoy some of his remarkable images, or to hear one of our panda friends' own ghost stories, you can come to our website, npr.org. Pleasure talking to you. Thanks so much.
Well, thank you, Scott.
Tomorrow is October 10, 2010. 10, 10, 10. Many people around the world have scheduled special events for the day, including weddings. Be kind of hard to forget that anniversary. The Michigan Sovereignty Tea Party will hold a rally in Lansing. Protesters against the death penalty are going to gather in front of the Supreme Court in Washington, D.C., and marathons are set for Melbourne and Buenos Aires. Whatever transpires on 10-10-10, anything and everything is of interest to a project called One Day on Earth. Videographers, amateur and professional from around the globe are free to participate and capture moments large and small, extraordinary and mundane.
If you believe in something, if you have one message you could put in the world's time capsule, one story that you can put in the record of history, we hope that you will be inspired and really go out and find it.
So 10-10-10 isn't necessarily just a day to record a cat flushing the toilet or games of beer pong. OneDayOnEarth.org is working with the United Nations Development Fund and groups including Oxfam, the American Red Cross, Human Rights Watch, and the World Wildlife Fund, hoping filmmakers will send in material that give us a deeper understanding of life on our planet. Kyle Ruddick is founder and director of the project. He joins us from the studios of NPR West. Thanks so much for being with us.
Good morning.
And what's the idea?
Well, the idea is that through participating simultaneously across the world and sharing experience that is important as well as inspiring, that we will have a picture of the planet that is more connected and I think a better understanding of our intertwined humanity, I guess.
What are some of the stories you're expecting?
There's a couple teams in Antarctica filming. We have the UNDP, which is the United Nations Development Program. They have over 120 people around the world participating on the front lines of a lot of the most intensely developing countries, I would say. We had a group from Afghanistan sign up a couple days ago. I was looking through their photos last night, and it's a lot of people that were hit with landmines. And these people are just eager to tell their story. We have a group of over 40 women who are expecting to give birth that day. If they give birth, they will be filming it.
Well, I hope someone will be filming it for them. Mothers are remarkable, don't get me wrong, but...
No, they will not be filming themselves. It's not like they set it up on a tripod.
And then what happens to all this material?
Well, all of the material gets uploaded to the site, and everyone who participates has their own page. Everything's geotagged, by the way. So you'll be able to search very quickly through the site and actually go by location to location and see where things are filmed. In addition to that, we're also making a film, and that film will be premiered sometime next fall.
We had a little bit of fun, if you please, suggesting this that you might be inundated with people sending you video of cats using a toilet at home. But, I mean, the more I think about it, Is that so terrible? I mean, is that also a way of marking what our world is?
Yeah, I was actually going to clarify something there. It's an open project. You know, how can I tell you what matters to you? For someone who loves that cat, that might be the happiest moment that they have all day.
Yeah. If you can get a cat who's flushing a toilet to draw attention to global warming, that would definitely fit into your parameters.
Especially if he could give a speech. I mean,
Kyle Ruddick, he's founder and director of One Day on Earth, alloneword.org. Tomorrow, 10-10-10, they're collecting material for a video time capsule from filmmakers, amateurs and professional around the world. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
There's a mosque under construction in the French Mediterranean port city of Marseille. The cornerstone's already been laid, but the project is far from being accepted by everyone. As Eleanor Beardsley reports, the controversy reflects the deeper tensions simmering beneath the city's surface.
An accordion player serenades tourists dining at outdoor cafes along Marseille's old port, France's oldest and second largest city, founded by Phoenician sailors in 600 BC, has absorbed waves of immigrants throughout its history and today is a melting pot of cultures. Stéphane Ravier's mother came here from Italy in the 1930s.
Bienvenue à Marseille et puis bon courage.
Today, the 41-year-old Ravier works for France Telecom. He's also a member of the right-wing political party, the National Front. Ravier says his grandparents gave their children French names so they could better assimilate. But, he says, Marseille's newest immigrants, Muslims from North Africa, do not make the same effort to fit in.
It's no longer about mixing populations so they can live together. We French are being replaced by another people, in their culture, religion, and way of life. The wave of immigration has been so huge in the last 20 years that we are being submerged.
As he rides his motorcycle through Marseille's traffic-choked streets, Ravier points out halal butchers, Islamic schools, and many women wearing headscarves, and even the all-encompassing Muslim veil known as the burqa. Ravier calls the newly planned mosque the straw that will break the camel's back, and that's why the National Front is trying to block its construction in court. Most of Marseille's 70 mosques are small and makeshift, operating out of garages and storefronts. This one near the city center is so packed during Friday prayers that the faithful flow out into the street to pray on flattened cardboard boxes. The new mosque, with room for 7,000 worshippers, is meant to change all that. Despite opposition from the far right, the mayor and a majority of the city's non-Muslims support the mosque, says local journalist Etienne Baudu.
It's not normal to pray in streets. And in Marseille, Muslims need a big mosque, a big one, like in Paris, like in Lyon. The problem with these street mosques is that Muslims, they feel rejected.
At the site of Marseille's future Grande Mosquée, a group of elderly men is playing a game of boules. The faces of the Frenchmen, who are Catholic and Jewish, are deeply tanned and wrinkled, attesting to a lifetime spent here under the Mediterranean sun. They say they are against the mosque, but their objections seem to be about more than religion. Most of Marseille's Muslims are from Algeria, a part of France until 1962, and the scars from colonization, the War of Independence, and the forced repatriation of 1 million Algerian-born French, known as Pieds Noirs, have not completely healed. 67-year-old René Gabila says he understands why the Algerians wanted their independence, but he says he wants to know why they are now invading France.
Ce sont des gens qui vivent totalement, ils ne veulent pas s'intégrer.
They come here, and then they live in their own world. They absolutely do not want to integrate. Look at these crazy burqas and things like that. How can we be expected to love them?
Today, at least a quarter of Marseille's 1 million inhabitants are thought to be Muslim. 39-year-old Omar Jalil was born in France of Algerian parents. Jalil sits in a cafe where the Arab language news channel Al Jazeera plays in the background. He talks about the barriers for Muslims in France.
Pourquoi on veut pas s'intégrer? Parce qu'il y a pas d'acceptation en face.
They say we don't want to integrate, but it's not true. We speak French. We try to be French, but they don't accept us. We're stuck in ghettos with poor schools. We can't create a Muslim elite. It's a little like how black Americans must have lived in 1930s Mississippi.
Jalil says that, like him, many young Muslims are now rejecting their French identity and turning, he says, toward the values and religion of their countries of origin. Eleanor Beardsley, NPR News, Marseille.